You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. The fight ahead. The Supreme Court's decision to end federal protections for abortion access didn't just rewind the clock 50 years. It opened a Pandora's box of confusing, potentially life-threatening legal complications. Vanity Fair talks with five women on the front lines, by Abigail Tracy and Aaron Vanderhoof, with photographs by Diana Markosian and Drew Donovan. Up to the challenge, in the courts, with so-called trigger bans, and in some cases abortion restrictions more than a century old in effect, many legal battles are still being fought in the courts in Georgia, Florida, Arizona, Oklahoma, North Dakota, and Ohio, among other states. In Idaho, for instance, the U.S. Justice Department sued the state, arguing its law would prevent emergency room doctors from performing abortions needed to stabilize a woman's health. In August, a federal court narrowly blocked a provision in the law, saying doctors could not be legally punished for protecting the health of a pregnant patient. On the ballot, over the summer, Kansas voters were the first to take abortion rights to the ballot box, and they fiercely rejected an initiative that would have stripped the right to an abortion from the state constitution. Abortion remains protected under the state constitution for up to 22 weeks. Ballot measures that could curb abortion access have also been introduced in Kentucky and Montana. In Kentucky, a constitutional amendment to include language stating that Kentucky's constitution does not secure or protect a right to abortion or funding of abortion is on the ballot. In Montana, voters will decide whether to give legal personhood to infants born alive at any stage of development following induced labor, C-section, and attempted abortion. The law sets a $50,000 fine and 20-year maximum prison sentence for violators. Meanwhile, voters in Vermont and California will decide whether to enshrine abortion protections in their state constitutions. In Congress, the Women's Health Protection Act failed in the Senate in May. The Ensuring Access to Abortion Act passed in the House in July. It has yet to receive a vote in the Senate. Caitlin Bernard, M.D., physician, Indiana, as interviewed by Abigail Tracy. Tattooed on Caitlin Bernard's left foot is the image of a coat hanger and the words "Trust Women." The 38-year-old Indiana-based OBGYN got it years ago. It was intended as a reminder of life before Roe v. Wade. Bernard has long paired her medical career with advocacy. She was a plaintiff in an unsuccessful 2019 American Civil Liberties Union lawsuit to reverse Indiana's near-total ban on second trimester abortions. Post-Roe, Indiana became the first state to pass an abortion ban. Now, Bernard is girding for another legal fight, this time against Republican Indiana Attorney General Todd Rokita, who she says maligned her practice as Bernard became a lightning rod in one of the most publicized cases after the Dobbs decision stripped federal abortion protections and turned the country into a patchwork of disparate laws. Bernard is the doctor who gave a 10-year-old rape victim from Ohio an abortion and spoke to the Indianapolis Star about the devastating case. Overnight, Bernard was forced into a glaring spotlight, a martyr to one side and a villain to the other. It was very scary, not knowing exactly what was going to happen, not knowing if this was going to impact my ability to continue working where I work, my ability to continue seeing patients, she says. And certainly, I was scared for my personal safety, for the safety of my family. For weeks, conservative politicians and members of even mainstream media sowed doubt that such a victim even existed. On national television, Ohio Attorney General David Yost said his office hadn't heard a whisper about the case. The Washington Post turned a suspicious fact-checker on the story. Then, the Columbus Dispatch reported that 27-year-old Gerson Fuentes confessed to police that he raped the girl on at least two occasions. As the truth sank in where it hadn't before, ire shifted to Bernard. Rokita opened an investigation, claiming the doctor had failed to report that abortion and others to the state. Official records show otherwise. Bernard cried defamation. The amount of work that we have to put in for each individual patient to be able to get the care that they need is really tremendous. Bernard, who previously worked in Missouri before joining Indiana University, says, that's what people in all of these abortion-restrictive states face, a mountain of hurdles, just to try to get basic health care for their patients. Even as she has faced threats, she had to hire security. More than fear, Bernard feels exhaustion. We're already having such a difficult time trying as hard as we can to take care of as many patients as we can, she says, of both working in Indiana and in Missouri. It really solidified my understanding of how important it was to have providers in those states, and not just providers of abortion access, but also providers of whole reproductive health, she says. People sometimes ask, why do we become advocates? Why is advocacy part of our job? And the reality is that we would all prefer to just be able to take care of our patients, she says. That's why we became physicians. A Lifetime of Roe, 1962, The Defenders brings abortion to network TV. The drama lost three of its advertisers after it became the first primetime show to mention abortion. 1965, Griswold versus Connecticut. The Supreme Court rules Connecticut has no right to ban contraceptives for married couples, reinforcing the constitutional right to privacy for when individuals make personal decisions about having a kid. 1969, National Association for the Repeal of Abortion Laws, NARAL, is founded. 1970, Hawaii and New York become the first states to legalize abortion. 1971, United States versus Witch. In its first case about abortion, the Supreme Court upholds a Washington, D.C. law prohibiting abortions with an exception for the woman's health and concludes that a woman's health encompasses psychological and physical well-being. 1973, Roe v. Wade. The Supreme Court's landmark decision invalidates a Texas abortion ban and grants federal protections for abortion prior to a fetus's viability. 1979, Baptist televangelist Jerry Falwell mobilizes conservative Christian voters behind the moral majority. 1982, the Federalist Society holds its first meetings. 1992, Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Casey. The Supreme Court upholds the right to an abortion, but introduces the undue burden standard on state abortion regulations. 1995, Norma McCorvey recants. The woman previously known as Jane Roe says she regretted taking part in the abortion rights movement. She would later claim she was paid by the anti-abortion movement. 2000, an abortion pill is approved. 2003, President George W. Bush signs a partial birth abortion ban into law. 2009, Late-term abortion doctor George Tiller is killed at his church. 2016, Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt. The Supreme Court reaffirms Roe and Casey. 2022, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. The Supreme Court upholds Mississippi's 15-week abortion ban and overturns Roe and Casey, ending federal protections for abortion rights. Fatima Goss Graves, National Women's Law Center President, Washington, D.C., interviewed by Abigail Tracy. It was shocking to see those words on paper. Fatima Goss Graves, President and CEO of the National Women's Law Center, says of the Dobbs decision. She sees the country grappling not just with a public health crisis, but a legal one, too. The deep reliance on the norms of 1865, a time where women in this country were not allowed to vote, weren't allowed to own property, weren't allowed to even practice law, those were the norms that had to guide a decision in 2022. Goss Graves, a longtime gender justice advocate and co-founder of the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund, took over the NWLC in 2017. A graduate of Yale Law School, Goss Graves, 46, cut her teeth clerking for Judge Diane Wood of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit and as a litigator before establishing herself as one of the foremost voices on women's and gender issues. Though she's been sounding the alarm for years, the fall of Roe hit Goss Graves hard. "I, on the day of the Dobbs decision, found myself feeling like I had been punched in the gut," she says. "I knew how many people were terrified for themselves, and I know how deeply personal abortion is, whether people tell their abortion stories or not. Everyone has one." Goss Graves operates alongside D.C. power brokers and often testifies before Congress and federal agencies. In the aftermath of Dobbs, her organization has worked closely with the Biden administration, which was criticized for appearing flat-footed in its response to the highly anticipated ruling. Among the NWLC's recommendations was for the Department of Health and Human Services to issue guidance to physicians on providing abortion care in emergency cases, which was adopted in July. "We will continue our advocacy for a focused effort both publicly and quietly, including toward the White House and, importantly, across agencies," she says. "The path forward is unclear," Goss Graves says, "but the goal is to amend the Constitution to enshrine the protections Roe had provided. Our ultimate North Star is that abortion should be available and accessible to all who want it," Goss Graves says, "whether that means deploying an existing network of lawyers to give legal advice to healthcare providers and individuals, or educating businesses on their powers. A critical piece of the puzzle," Goss Graves explains, "is working to destigmatize abortion. Turning it into something shameful has been a successful tactic by those who want to continue to oppress," she says. She's also looking ahead to future battles like the right to contraception. "I have been, in these last few months, watching our legal system absorb this shock on top of the individuals," Goss Graves says. "And lawyers like certainty, right? When you're in the business of building your advice on past practice and precedents, you like certainty. And so we're also in this situation where our very foundations that have undergirded the rule of law, that have sort of allowed us to feel very stable around the advice we give, around what the parameters are, all of that also feels fragile and not secure. What I know is that in the end, we will win. And so the question is just going to be, you know, what is the timetable? When does it happen?" Opposing force. Catherine Glenn Foster, President, Americans United for Life, Washington, D.C., as interviewed by Aaron Vanderhoof. In a July hearing about a post-Roe America in front of the House Judiciary Committee, Catherine Glenn Foster left California Representative Eric Swalwell confused. Foster, a lawyer and the chief executive of Americans United for Life, had just said that a 10-year-old rape victim from Ohio, forced to travel across state lines for an abortion, the subject of a widespread news report, had technically not gotten an abortion. "Wait," said Swalwell, "it would not be an abortion if a 10-year-old with her parents made a decision not to have a baby that was the result of a rape," Foster responded coolly and assuredly. "If a 10-year-old became pregnant as a result of rape and it was threatening her life, then that's not an abortion," she said. "So it would not fall under any abortion restriction in our nation." Foster's argument about the definition of abortion has become more commonplace in her movement in an attempt to put intent ahead of physical procedure. Foster and her group rhetorically exempt an array of situations, such as an ectopic pregnancy or a case like the 10-year-old's, from its legal definition of abortion. But the actual laws AUL advocates for are written in grayer terms. In Texas, such uncertainty around miscarriage and ectopic care has already led to increasingly maternal morbidity. When AUL announced Foster's appointment in May 2017, board members praised both her legal mind and her willingness to tell her life story. In 2000, she accidentally became pregnant and went to an abortion clinic. She says she changed her mind as the procedure was about to begin and asked to leave. In interviews, often in Christian and Catholic news outlets, Foster goes on to describe a sadistic assault in which the doctor called for nurses to hold her down as he aborted her pregnancy while she screamed. In a 2019 interview with Foster, the Daily Caller noted, due to the traumatic nature of the incident, Foster said she cannot recall the qualifications of staff in the abortion clinic and the name of the doctor. Founded in the years before Roe v. Wade, AUL quickly established itself as a major player in anti-abortion legal strategy, pushing successfully for informed consent laws and other barriers to access. In the 5 years since Foster was named the head of AUL, she has become a frequent guest at congressional hearings about reproductive health and abortion at the behest of Republican lawmakers. In statements submitted to lawmakers ahead of time, she shows off finely tuned legal argumentation befitting someone trained at the Georgetown University Law Center. In the chair, she uses more extreme, visceral language. "Fetuses are torn limb from limb," she said during a May 2022 House Judiciary Committee hearing. "Bodies are thrown in medical waste bins, and in places like Washington, D.C., burned to power the lights of the city's homes and streets. Let that image sit with you for a moment. The next time you turn on the light, think of the incinerators." The fall of Roe appears to have expanded Foster's and her group's ambitions. "Our workload just tripled," Foster told Catholic outlet Eladia, boasting about how many state abortion restrictions her group has inspired. "And we're going to be in those blue states. We have a blue state strategy, and we're going to do everything we can to educate, to push back, to defend life." Catherine Colbert, retired reproductive rights attorney, Pennsylvania, interviewed by Abigail Tracy. "The scene outside the Supreme Court was chaotic as media crews, reporters, and activists awaited a landmark decision. Catherine Colbert, the American Civil Liberties Union attorney who had argued the case on behalf of abortion providers and clinics, was bracing for the worst. But in a shocking turn, three justices appointed by Republican presidents, Anthony Kennedy, Sandra Day O'Connor, and David Souter, tipped the scales in Planned Parenthood v. Casey. It was June 29, 1992. Roe v. Wade stood. The only inclination Colbert had received that perhaps she might prevail came from one of the opposing counsel, Kenneth Starr. As Colbert recalls it, he said, "The Court of Appeals has been vindicated, a hint that he had obviously seen the opinion, and it wasn't as I expected, but it was significant. The reality is we still had legal abortion for 30 years as a result of Casey, she says. Colbert, 70, grew up in Michigan and attended Cornell University before getting her law degree from Temple University. She was recruited to work as a staff attorney at the Women's Law Project in 1979. Her first day on the job, she was sent to the Philadelphia City Council to try to defeat an anti-abortion bill on behalf of abortion providers in the state. She was successful. In her career, she's argued on behalf of abortion providers in front of the Supreme Court twice. It's so personal, she says, explaining why she chose a career fighting to protect access to abortion. Everybody has a story. My mom had an abortion. My aunt had an abortion. My daughter had an abortion. I had a problem with a pregnancy. Everybody's story is a deep thing. She added, as a lesbian with a partner, now wife, two children, and now four grandchildren, I always cared deeply about reproductive freedom and the ability of all people to freely decide whether, when, how, and with whom to have children. In 1992, Colbert and a number of her colleagues from the ACLU co-founded the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy, now known as the Center for Reproductive Rights, a global legal advocacy organization. From 1992 to 1997, Colbert headed the legal and policy teams, during which time the organization won two landmark cases in Alaska and Minnesota, strengthening abortion protections at the state level. Now retired, she has continued to speak publicly about the end of Roe, discussing with lawyers and activists across the country how to navigate the new landscape. Last year, Colbert and Julie F. Kay, a women's rights attorney and activist, co-wrote the book on it, Controlling Women, What We Must Do Now to Save Reproductive Freedom. After a career of fighting these battles in the judicial system, she's had a change of heart. I learned from Casey and Dobbs that it is dangerous and foolish to depend solely on the courts to protect our reproductive freedoms, she says. The most effective safeguard is to maintain political power in all branches of government, particularly state legislatures and Congress. Since Donald Trump's election in 2016, Colbert had steeled herself all over again for the fall of Roe, but she says today's court is far different. Colbert wasn't prepared for the Dobbs ruling to be littered with what she has characterized as radical language. The Dobbs ruling created a roadmap on taking away other rights that are based on substantive due process, she says. It's just striking in its breadth. It also uses the language of the anti-abortion movement in a way that really confirms the partisan nature of the decision. Ultimately, in her view, the Constitution must be amended, an effort that has stalled at the federal level, with Republicans standing in staunch opposition and Democrats unable to overcome the Senate 60-vote filibuster threshold on their own. It took our opponents 50 years to overturn Roe, and it may take us nearly that long to win back the legal protections we had that Roe gave us, in their full sense. That's a long, long fight, she says. What do we ultimately need in the shorter term? We need to win that political power in the states and in Congress. And the only way to do that is hard work. It's not just one election. It is every election, every year. In the photo, March of Time, retired attorney Catherine Kitty Colbert, who co-founded the Center for Reproductive Rights in Portland, Oregon. Marva Sadler, Senior Director of Clinical Services, Whole Woman's Health, Texas, interviewed by Aaron Vanderhoof. In the photo, Forging a Path, Marva Sadler, Senior Director of Clinical Services of Whole Woman's Health in San Antonio. When Marva Sadler first began working in reproductive health care, She didn't exactly understand the controversy she was diving into. I walked into my first day of work, absolutely floored that there were protesters outside of the clinic, and by what they were saying, I could not believe that, she explained recently. Her upbringing in Waco, Texas, led her to see abortion as necessary, but not a topic of polite conversation. In a house with my mother and my grandmother and my two sisters, so a house full of women where it was just, we didn't talk about abortion. If you needed it and that's what you wanted to do, you went and did that. There's no more time for subtlety, says Sadler. I'd like to think, in a perfect world, that there are people who could agree to disagree, but it's not enough to do that at this point, she says. My human rights need to be protected. My daughter's human rights need to be protected. My granddaughters, my future great-great-granddaughters, their rights should be protected. Whole Woman's Health has given its name to two major Supreme Court cases. Sadler is the senior director of clinical services for the entire organization. She took the job in 2008 after 3 years working at other clinics and has been immersed in the group's political project ever since. A major facet of the job is addressing racial disparities in maternal mortality and the inequities that women in poverty face. When Texas passed Senate Bill 8 in May 2021, the state banned abortion at approximately 6 weeks and made bounty hunters out of citizens who are authorized to sue anyone who helps provide an abortion, a doctor, a driver, someone who donates funds, and collect $10,000 or more if successful. Last spring, Sadler, alongside former gubernatorial candidate Wendy Davis, and two other advocates, became a plaintiff in a suit that challenged aspects of that law. Rupali Sharma, lead counselor on the case, Davis et al. Versus Sharp, says the law runs afoul of Texans' rights even without federal abortion protections. You can't, without any connection to an incident, without any connection to someone, haul them into court and then get potentially hundreds and thousands of dollars, she says. For Sadler, the vitriol that came in her state have lobbed at her colleagues made her participation in the suit imperative. My husband asked me the same thing probably every day at this point. What made me decide to get involved in that, she says. It was time to step out into a different realm, to be a part of saying enough. Cece Caruso, organizing manager Plan C, Nevada, interviewed by Aaron Vanderhoof. About twice a month, Caitlin Cece Caruso logs in for a Zoom call from a bright Las Vegas workspace and gets face-to-face with a new batch of volunteers ready to be trained. In the calls, Caruso walks a couple dozen recruits through the basics of self-managed abortion while weaving a broader story about the reproductive justice movement and the way a generation of young activists are looking to understand the mistakes that led to the erosion of abortion rights. After the Dobbs draft decision leaked in May, the sessions grew larger and larger, and within 3 months, Caruso says, they had trained more than 1,500 people. Caruso, 25, is the digital organizing manager for Plan C, a political advocacy group that runs a website with up-to-date and accessible information about medical abortions. Its name is a play on Plan B, the brand name for a common form of emergency contraception. But Plan C, the abortion pills, works even after an embryo has implanted. Caruso's interest in policy and progressive advocacy was informed by a series of childhood experiences. They were in and out of homelessness in New York City until age 10, when their mom moved the family to Nevada. In middle school, they wanted to start a gay-straight alliance, and their principal blocked the effort. I have a problem with authority, and I wouldn't take no for an answer, they say. I never stopped organizing after that. In college at University of Nevada, Las Vegas, Caruso learned the history of reproductive justice and movement building, but their passion comes from a few personal early lessons. My mom always told me, I had you and your sister. I put up a child for adoption, and I had an abortion, and all three were difficult in their own way, and in all three, I deserved and needed support, Caruso says. That's how I found myself in the reproductive justice movement. This movement has the opportunity and the potential to really create the world that my mom deserves. Caruso's work at Plan C illustrates how much has changed since the anti-abortion movement first agitated against medical abortions, long before the drug reached the American market. Mifepristone was initially publicized as RU486, a science fiction-sounding name assigned by the scientist who synthesized it in the 1980s, and early media discussions foregrounded factual uncertainty about its safety. But after a concerted effort by a handful of abortion proponents, the FDA approved the combination of misoprostol and mifepristone in 2000. Since then, medical abortions have been prescribed to millions of patients and have accounted for 54% of the nation's total. Understanding the shifting landscape, anti-abortion groups are renewing their attacks on the drug in the Dobbs era with a rehashing of old rhetoric, along with creative laws targeting telemedicine prescriptions. Unfortunately, we are seeing this great push towards self-managed abortion because many people aren't going to have other options, Caruso says. But Plan C's mission is as ideological as it is practical. Caruso's training teaches abortion supporters how to spread the message that self-managed abortions can be done safely and discreetly, in the hope that the notion of the dangerous back-alley abortion can remain in the past. Caruso's work also emphasizes intersectionality and gender inclusivity, they say, to make sure that people know the legacy of the movement that we're working within, so that we don't necessarily risk repeating the mistakes of the past. The past is present. Half a century ago, amid Supreme Court hearings on Roe v. Wade, racial reckonings, and political tension, a group of women launched Ms. Magazine. Here, Gloria Steinem reflects on that first year. By Keziah Weir. In the photos, all in, Gloria Steinem at a staff meeting for Ms. Magazine in New York City in 1975. Today, Ms. is published quarterly by the Feminist Majority Foundation. Steinem at her desk. Steinem at her home office. Steinem with freelance designer Barbara Krauss, a whiz with the X-Acto knife. Staff portrait in 1972. Steinem, Ronnie Eldridge, and Ms. co-founder Patricia Carbine, circa 1970. To hear Gloria Steinem describe the Ms. Magazine office during its inaugural year of 1972 calls to mind a feminist worker's utopia. The editorial team conducted meetings in a talking circle, passing a stick to indicate who was speaking. Salaries were need-based. When not in the tot lot, the art director's five-year-old delivered mail via tricycle. 50 years later, to flip through the magazine's first year is to fall into something of a time warp. I didn't anticipate then, says Steinem, that I would be here at age 88, confronting not exactly the same versions of issues, but the same kinds of issues. Child care, pay equality, mass incarceration, Angela Davis on the importance of writing for, about, and by black women, Cynthia Ozick on the absurdity of defining a person by their organs. If anatomy were destiny, the wheel could not have been invented. We would have been limited by legs. And abortion. To many American women and men, it seems absurd in this allegedly enlightened age that we should still be arguing for a simple principle that a woman has the right to sovereignty over her own body. Reads a call to action signed by 53 women, including Dorothy Pittman Hughes, Billie Jean King, and Nora Ephron. It ran in the 1972 preview issue, released a year before the Roe v. Wade decision. Of today's debate over inclusive language, you could just say people with wombs, Steinem says. It doesn't need to be complicated. As in the pursuit of any nuanced cause, factions were nearly inevitable. Radical feminist Vivian Gornick would part ways with the magazine early on over philosophical differences. In the mid-80s, Alice Walker would resign, citing an unrealized desire for more people of color on the cover. Gornick would remain a Ms. defender, and Walker a friend of Steinem's. There was always a consciousness that we were trying to do something that hadn't been done, Steinem says of that time, however imperfectly we'd be doing it. And in the next photos, cover to cover, Ms. Magazine spreads from its inaugural year, including the spring 1972 We Have Had Abortions campaign, a reevaluation of Wonder Woman in July 1972, and Alice Walker's short story, Rose Lily, which appeared in August 1972 and would go on to open her debut collection in Love and Trouble, Stories of Black Women, the following year. the Queen Mother. The question of reparations couldn't be more urgent as the health care crisis for Black Americans worsens. In Queen Mother, Audley Moore, we have a newly relevant template for change. By A. Kirsten Mullen, with painting of Audley Moore by Charlie Palmer. Something that is often missing from reparations talk, legal scholar Alfred Brophy observed in 2010, is a specific plan for repairing past tragedies. California and New York have joined the dozen or so states and municipalities that have initiated what they are calling reparations programs. As a core platform issue, presidential candidate Marianne Williamson proposed up to $500 billion in payments to the descendants of U.S. slavery, but even that was woefully inadequate. Enslaved Africans were the first abolitionists, seizing every possible moment to liberate themselves and their families, and they were the first architects of reparations. Other groups in the U.S. have developed successful redress strategies. Holocaust victims, Japanese Americans unjustly incarcerated during World War II, 9/11 victims, the Iran hostages, victims of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting, and many others. But Black American descendants of U.S. slavery have come up empty-handed. The racial wealth gap is the most robust indicator of the cumulative economic effects of white supremacy in the United States. It is, on average, about $850,000 per Black household, for a total of $14 trillion. The annual budgets of all 50 states and every municipality in the country combined is about $4.68 trillion. Only the federal government has the capacity to pay the bill, and a sufficient proportion of white Americans must support doing so. Qualitative profiles, stories, and narratives capture people emotionally, but they often are dismissed as purely anecdotal. Numbers establish patterns that can be generalized to a larger group. Black nationalist Queen Mother Audley Moore understood the importance of documenting racial disparities, and she believed in taking complaints to a higher authority. In 1957, the Black Power pioneer presented a petition to the United Nations demanding land for Black Americans and billions of dollars in reparations, and in 1963, she launched the Committee for Reparations for Descendants of U.S. Slaves. Pan-Africanist invoke Moore's name because she also embraced decolonization and freedom for Africa and believed the federal government should provide funds to Black Americans who wanted to repatriate to the continent. Moore appears to be consistent in arguing that reparations from the U.S. government should go to Blacks whose ancestors were enslaved here, and not to Blacks who migrated here after slavery ended, particularly the large number who came after the passage of the Civil Rights Act. Several of her more vocal disciples, however, have used her ideological Pan-Africanism to put words in Moore's mouth, ones that support the claim that U.S. reparations should go to all people of African descent. Equal parts oracle, badass, and political strategist, Moore and her collaborators launched the campaign to demand reparations in New Orleans in 1955 after concluding it was the only way to save our people from execution. She was not the first person to endorse a national reparations program for Black American descendants of U.S. slaves. That distinction goes to Callie Guy House, who was born into slavery around 1861 in Rutherford County near Nashville. As her biographer, Mary Frances Berry, documents in My Face is Black is True, Callie House and the Struggle for Ex-Slave Reparations, House tirelessly petitioned the U.S. government for pensions, a form of reparations, for the 1.9 million people formerly enslaved, including the more than 180,000 Black soldiers who fought in the Union Army during the Civil War. White veterans received pensions from the federal government, House observed, why not blacks? Moore was born in New Iberia, Louisiana, at the tail end of Reconstruction in 1898, the same year House co-founded the National Ex-Slave Mutual Relief, Bounty, and Pension Association. Moore's mother, Ella Henry, had been educated in France after a wealthy white family chose Henry as their daughter's companion. Better a black child they could control than the poor whites whom they despised. But Henry died in childbirth when Moore was 5 years old. Her father, Sincere Moore, an assistant deputy sheriff who had been run out of a nearby town for retaliating in kind against a white neighbor who had horsewhipped his young son, would die before Moore reached adolescence. Sincere's mother was the daughter of an enslaved woman and the white plantation man who had raped her, and Henry's father had been lynched trying to protect his land. When Moore was very young, around the time her mother died, she witnessed a lynching in New Iberia. I remember the hollering, white men like wolves, and the black man's feet was tied behind the wagon, and he passed in front of our house, she said. His head was bumping up and down on the clay on the hard, crusty road. Moore's lived experience would define her trajectory. An organizational zealot, Moore was a member of the Communist, Republican, and Democratic parties, as well as, she said, the Elks and the Masons. She was a Catholic, an ordained bishop, and a convert to the Baptist and Ethiopian Orthodox communities of faith and the Apostolic Orthodox Church of Judah. I've got all the religions, she said years later. I have one objective, win 'em for freedom. One might wonder if she ever worked for the FBI, which built a copious file on Moore over a 20-year period. Apparently, the agency did approach her in the 1940s to become an informant. Her account of what took place, I'll tell you the truth, when I am in my right mind, I could join the Ku Klux Klan and know why I'm there, you understand? I could join the police force if I had to. In 1919, during the Red Summer, white terrorists launched upwards of 40 attacks on black communities. The heroic military service of more than 380,000 blacks during World War I had not brought an end to disenfranchisement and segregation, debt peonage, and racial violence. White supremacy at home proved to be a more invincible foe than the German army. Blacks in Louisiana and elsewhere were desperate to see an end to the carnage and the destruction of black property, but they did not have the capacity to make this happen. Marcus Garvey believed the solution lay with blacks themselves. Like his hero, Booker T. Washington, he embraced respectability politics. Blacks must accept responsibility for improving themselves to show white Americans they are worthy of equal rights. First, though, they must accept and celebrate their African past and be proud of their black skin. The next year, 1920, Garvey was scheduled to speak in New Orleans, but was arrested. When he was released the following day, he returned to the Longshoremen Hall to bring his message of Africa for Africans and back to Africa, the place where all black people could be proud, unified, and self-sufficient. The police, on alert to arrest him again at the least provocation, had not counted on the crowd arriving armed to the teeth, ready to defend Garvey, Moore, and her family among them. The police withdrew. The Moores briefly contemplated moving to Africa, but decided to relocate to Harlem instead. First, they took a month-long trip to Los Angeles, where Moore met several women in what was called Black Society, who took her to Santa Monica, where they wanted to charge us $5 for a bottle of 5-cent soda. She became disillusioned until all the people there said, "Oh, my dear, if it's freedom you're looking for, we could have told you we have discrimination in California. Where you should have gone was Chicago." So the Moores traveled to Chicago, where they found conditions worse than in New Orleans. "Oh," they said, "my dear, it's not here. Harlem's where you need to go." Now, I didn't realize Harlem, too, was Jim Crow. No blacks were hired as bus or streetcar drivers, and no one could find a job in their own neighborhood. Black women stood on the street corners, and the Jewish women used to come, almost just like slavery days, feel their muscles, look at their knees to see if they had crust on their knees, evidence that they could get on their knees to wax their floors, she recalled years later. That was when Moore committed herself to the movement. After Garvey was indicted on mail fraud charges in 1922 and deported to Jamaica in 1927, Moore turned her attention to the work that would lead to what historian Ashley D. Farmer, who is writing a biography of Moore, calls her pioneering role in forging the modern reparations movement. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.